Finally, a rescue in Chile. The real statistics on marriage. Evolution and the empty nest. A shift on gay marriage. Sex and the Bible. Teens and texting. It's Wednesday, October 13, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The scenes from the rescue deep in that mine in Chile are moving, and they're pretty spectacular. As of this morning, several of the miners who had been trapped so desperately beneath the surface of the earth had been rescued, and their loved ones were seen receiving them as the images were live-streamed and broadcast around the world. What we see in these particular pictures is a reminder of the human determination to live. Now, naturalists looking at this try to explain it in terms of an evolutionary impulse. However, we need to recognize that the Creator put within each of His human creatures a deep desire to live. But not just to live, but to live together. The story coming out of Chile indicates that these miners kept themselves alive by encouraging one another, taking care of one another. The teamwork that has been demonstrated by these particular trapped miners is a sign of what human beings can do at the very best. It's a sign of what urgency can call out in human beings who are in the most desperate situations. Now, looking at the situation in terms of the loved ones and the big picture, these people who are now so happy, wives especially receiving their husbands from the subterranean prison, have demonstrated the strength of marriage, the love of one spouse for another, the love of family. Also, there's a deep patriotic impulse here, as the nation of Chile was represented by its president and senior mining officials who had put their reputations on the line to lead this rescue effort of miners who, after all, have been trapped since August the 5th. This one's going to go down in the books. This is the longest period of time that trapped miners have lived under the surface of the earth and then been successfully rescued. This is one of the largest numbers of miners ever trapped together, and in one of the deepest mines ever to experience this kind of an accident. These men lived for about 69 days under the surface of the earth in situations of tremendous danger. Up until the very last minute, it was not clear that this Phoenix 1 rescue capsule would work. Even as by early morning a good number of these miners had been rescued, the relief of the nation was really shared globally, with the relief of peoples of all nations experiencing the joy of this country of Chile, and especially of the loved ones and the miners, as they are reunited. Medical tests will be done and follow-up studies will be conducted, but we're going to learn a great deal not only about mining in this situation, but about the strength of the human spirit. Turning to the United States, much has been made in recent days of a series of marriage studies, research indicating, for example, that for the first time in American history, 30-year-olds with college degrees are more likely to be married than 30-year-olds without. In a more alarming statistic, it is indicated that for the first time in our nation's history, Americans aged 25 to 34 who are married fell below the proportion who have never been married. But Justin Wolfers, reporting in the New York Times, brings some clarity to these statistics. He points out, for example, that many of the media reports on these research projects have misreported the data and certainly misinterpreted it. He points out, for example, that if you look at the number of marriage certificates issued, there is somewhat of a decline over the last 30 years, but only in terms of a very long-term pattern. Now, what Mr. Wolfers indicates is that in our haste to see marriage in distress, we often fail to see that the majority of Americans actually will get married, and many of them, certainly most of them, will be married by age 40. He points out that the current recession, often referred to by some economists as the he-cession, has had a disproportionate effect on men, and in particular on young men with no college degrees. They now have an economic reason not to marry earlier, the researchers indicate. But by age 40, most Americans have married. Mr. Walters also indicates that, for the first time in recent years, marriages are lasting longer. Now, these are mere statistics. They don't tell us a great deal about any couple or any individual, but they do give us large-scale landscape pictures of the state of marriage in this country. What Mr. Wolfers underlines is the fact that we are in a 30-year period of renegotiating marriage, a slide-in effect of marriage in terms of the expectation of adults in this nation. The most alarming part of this research has to do with when people get married and how long they are married. The when has to do with the fact that delayed adulthood is certainly a part of our marriage landscape. Young Americans are not growing up and getting married on time. Instead, they are delaying marriage. And one of the helpful aspects of Justin Wolfer's interpretation of this data is that the economic recession really isn't an adequate justification or explanation for this pattern. No, you have to look back over three decades. And looking back over three decades, the patterns are remarkably consistent, whether the times economically are good or bad, whether in a bull market or a bear market, in an up economy or a down economy. The reality is that this nation is changing its view of marriage, its marriage practice, its marriage anticipations. Now, the research coming out certainly rings several very significant alarm bells. Those of us who are very concerned about marriage should look to this data, and we should not be tossed to and fro by every statistic. We need to take the kind of long-term and in-depth analysis that is offered in the New York Times by Justin Wolfers. He doesn't tell us that marriage isn't in trouble. He doesn't tell us that we should not be concerned. He does tell us that the recession itself is not the main factor in the delay of marriage, in the breakup of marriage, or in the net number of marriages. But he also documents the fact that marriage is in a 30-year pattern of decline, and there is no reason, looking at this data, to expect that that statistic is going to be turned around anytime soon. Michael Shermer is the publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He writes a monthly column for Scientific American. He's an adjunct professor at Claremont Graduate University. He has written a fascinating column in USA Today, and it's the kind of column that attracts our attention precisely because of its mode of argument. The title of his article is this, Making Sense of the Empty Nest Syndrome. He writes about what we have been noting in many media reports and the kind of news and reports coming from colleges and universities indicating that parents, baby boomer parents, the parents of today's college students, and especially this year's college freshmen, are having a very difficult time making the break, allowing their children to go to college. Some of these colleges are reporting that the parents bringing their kids to the campus actually didn't seem to want to go home. Some refer to these parents as helicopter parents who seem unable to cut the apron strings. Michael Shermer says all of this is explainable. He suggests that as we try to understand the affection between parents and children, we need to look at, well, here it comes, evolution. He is deeply committed to evolution and to an evolutionary worldview. And, as is becoming increasingly clear across the field of intellectual endeavor, if you are committed to the theory of evolution, it is so comprehensive that eventually you have to use evolution to explain everything. Every relationship, every thought, every experience, every idea is ultimately accountable to evolution. Well, let me tell you what that looks like. Michael Shermer explains that the relationship, the affection, the love between parents and children is explainable in physiological, evolutionary terms. He writes this, "We parents can't help feeling this way, and neuroscience explains why. Addictive chemicals such as dopamine and oxytocin surge through the brain and body during positive social interactions, especially touch. This causes us to feel closer to one another. Between parents and offspring, it cements a bond so solid that it is broken only under the most unusual and usually pathological circumstances." You heard that right. Your affection for your child is just a matter of physiology, of brain chemicals. He concludes his article saying this, "Each of us parents makes one small contribution to the evolutionary imperative of life's continuity from one generation to the next without a single gap." He suggests that this evolutionary succession is an unbroken link over the eons, glorious in its contiguity and spiritual in its contemplation. End quote. Now, what all this tells us is that the evolutionary worldview is just as bleak and dismal as we thought it was. In this case, the love of parents to children and children to parents is reduced to nothing more than brain interactions and chemicals and physiology. I can't imagine anything more depressing than believing that humanity is just an evolutionary product and our deepest and most precious relationships are nothing but physiological transactions. I suppose that Michael Shermer wrote this article for USA Today in hopes of encouraging parents to understand that their feelings for their children are not unusual but physiologically explainable. My guess is that real parents reading this article are not going to find the evolutionary worldview in Mr. Shermer's explanation very encouraging at all. I guess at the end of the day, I certainly hope not. Moral revolutions rarely happen with such speed as we are now witnessing on the issue of homosexuality in general and same-sex marriage in particular. Over the last decade or so, we have seen a massive swing, but over the period of the last 3 to 4 years, we have seen a seismic shift. Now CNN is reporting from wire reports and from basic research coming in from across the country that for the first time in the nation's history, less than half of adult Americans oppose gay marriage. Now, this doesn't mean that a majority of Americans support same-sex marriage and its legalization, but it does tell us that for the first time, the number of Americans who oppose same-sex marriage has dropped beneath the 50th percentile. Now, the data coming in from the Pew Center indicates that this is especially true as you look at a generational comparison. The millennial generation, that is those born after the 1980s, favor gay marriage by 53% to 39%. Among those born between 1928 and 1945, that is the older cohort of Americans, just 29% favor same-sex marriage, while 59% are opposed. There is also a partisan divide. According to the Pew Center, 53% of Democrats support same-sex marriage, while only 24% of Republicans do. Now, the great cultural divide in this country runs over issues that range from abortion to euthanasia, the size of government, and certainly matters of sexuality. But we are discovering, as indicated by this data and similar research, that the divide on the issue of sexual ethics is increasingly generational. And this means that on the issue of same-sex marriage, the momentum has greatly shifted towards the legalization of homosexual relationships and the eventual normalization of homosexual behaviors and lifestyles. All of this comes now as not so much of a shock, but as an affirmation that we are experiencing the kind of moral revolution many of us have been observing and many of us have been fearing. What we see in this research is that generational differences matter. We should understand that these generational differences are sometimes unpredictable. When you look at the generation known as the millennials, they tend to be very pro-life, even more pro-life than their parents and grandparents. But when it comes to matters of sexuality, they just don't want to draw clear black and white distinctions. This generation of young people is finding it increasingly different, even among Christian young people, to tell anyone, especially their peers, that what they're doing and how they're loving is wrong. This research is a sobering wake-up call. The Boston Globe recently featured an interview with author Michael Coogan. He's a religious studies professor at Stonehill College in Massachusetts. He also serves as director of publications for the Harvard Semitic Museum. He's written a new book entitled God and Sex, What the Bible Really Says. When I saw it in a bookstore, I immediately picked it up. It is published in a leatherette edition that makes it look somewhat like a Bible, a very interesting marketing plan. Professor Coogan doesn't much like the sexual morality of the Bible. He is seeking in this book to clarify it, but also, to a significant degree, to correct it. In the interview with the Boston Globe, he made some interesting statements. For instance, he suggests, and I quote, that the current scholarly consensus is that the Bible was written by many authors, mostly men, over the course of 1,000 years or so, a span of time and geography that inevitably leads to questions, inconsistencies, and cultural misunderstanding. Those who take its meaning literally, isolating single passages to guide modern behavior, do so at their peril. Now, that's a fascinating statement. Of course, it relativizes the scripture, and it suggests that an attempt to reach a sexual morality and to understand that morality from the scriptures must be either by isolating individual passages or by a failure to understand the distance between the culture of the Bible and our own. Now, as he tries to clarify in his own sense the sexual morality of the Bible, he makes some statements that are very appealing to a secular culture. He says, for example, that Jesus said nothing about homosexuality. Well, that's true if you're going to be looking at the direct discourse of Jesus in the four Gospels, but what you fail to see in this book and in the approach of so many other liberal scholars is that Jesus clearly affirmed the sexual purpose of humanity as directed towards heterosexual marriage. He left no room whatsoever for any other legitimate form or expression of human sexuality. At the end of the interview, Professor Coogan was asked, given all these inconsistencies, how should contemporary readers look to the Bible on these questions? He answered, I use the analogy of the Constitution. because it too is very much a product of a different time, and it reflects the values of its framers. But underlying the Constitution is a profound ideal. And I think underlying the Bible are a number of profound ideals as well. In my view, the underlying message of the Bible as a whole is loving the neighbor as oneself. End quote. That's the kind of liberal reductionism that denies the Bible's authority and leaves moderns able to define whatever they want in terms of human nature, human identity, human purpose, human flourishing, and of course, human sexuality. This relativizing of the Bible is not indeed a clarification of the Bible's message. It's not even directly a correction of the Bible's message. It is a relativizing of everything we find in Scripture. We are rightly paying a lot of attention these days to the interactions between human beings and technology. In particular, there is a good deal of very legitimate parental interest in how our children and how young adults are engaging the world of social media. A news report indicates that a 13-year-old girl, Brianna Hendrickson of Brooklyn, New York, won a $50,000 scholarship at the National Texting Championship. That's right, there is now a National Texting Championship, something of a social media Olympics. She won it by typing a verse from Old MacDonald, the children's song. She did so in 60 seconds. Now, a note in the press report from this event indicates that Brianna, again, remember she's age 13, sends about 6,000 text messages a month. Now, you might look at that and think that this is an isolated teenager in an isolated incident. But remember that the recent study released by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that a very frightening percentage of American adolescents are sending thousands of text messages per month. It's a sobering reminder of the fact that our children are so deeply invested in social media, and it ought to set off an alarm to parents to get control while there's time. Human beings are infatuated with technology, and we tend to think that technology can resolve almost any problem. But sometimes the technologies backfire. A recent report indicates that Volvo, the automobile manufacturing company, has been testing a pedestrian avoidance system for its cars. Testing it in front of an audience of journalists in Italy, the auto company was rather disappointed to see its car run over three test dummies. I guess sometimes we need our confidence in technology to be pierced and deflated right before our eyes. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. This is Heritage Week on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. This week, each October brings many guests to the campus, including our Board of Trustees, our Board of the Southern Seminary Foundation, and prospective students. It's a week of great activity and three very important chapel services. On Tuesday, just yesterday, I preached in chapel in the first service of Heritage Week a message from Psalm 116 entitled, "Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of His saints." The scripture presents such a comprehensive understanding of death and its meaning. It puts it in the context of creation, fall, redemption, and new creation. It sets before our eyes an understanding of death that is necessary for our understanding of sin, of judgment, and of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It sets before us the humbling reality of our finitude and mortality and points to our need to Christ and of Christ's victory over the grave and of the hope that due to Christ is now within us. You'll find this message by going to sbts.edu and looking at the front page, and you'll find a host of other messages and other presentations under resources. You'll find that at sbts.edu. Again, thanks for listening. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.